This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome to Circus Maximus, everybody, and today is May 27th, 2016. I'm your host, Nick Spiro, and you're on the Renegade Broadcasting Network. Feel free to chime in and chat with everybody in our chat room, and we also have a call-in number. You guys can call in a little bit later on in the show, but in the first hour, we're going to be involved with a lot of information. I do have a guest on this evening. His name is Jonathan Azaziah, and Jonathan and I go way back to 2008 when MySpace was the thing to do, like your Facebook and your Twitter of today. Him and I collaborated and connected on information. We shared a lot of information with one another, and then we decided to get together and do a podcast on Blog Talk Radio. That lasted for a few months. That was in 2008, and the show was Black Sheep Radio. Him and I have actually met in person. He's a fine gentleman. I do have a lot of respect for this man. Some of you might not appreciate him, but I do, and I hope you give him the same respect that I give him. If you are into the Middle Eastern information, this is your go-to man. He is a wise person when it comes to what's going on in the Middle East. And his website is Moqawa. Hey, can you pronounce that for me, Jonathan? I'm terrible at it. Go ahead.
No problem, my brother. Moqawamamusic.net.
Okay. And you also have a podcast that is posted on the Ugly Truth Network. And you also have a website by the Mask of Zion, and that is not really being updated as frequently as your new website that you're promoting today. Is that correct?
Yeah, all of my old essays from 2010 to 2014 you can still find on Mask of Zion, but all of the newer work you'll find on mukawamamusic.net.
Did you merge a lot of your information from Mask of Zion on your new website?
Absolutely. All the old stuff from Mask of Zion is now on Mukawama Music, as is a lot of the old information from my dear brother Martin Iqbal, who he runs Empire Strikes Black, and my old friend and partner in rhyme, who you also know, Naveed Khan, a.k.a. Khanverse, a lot of his old essays from Lost Scribe Media and even from the MySpace days are now on Mukawama Music as well.
And you also collaborate with music when it comes – actually, you collaborate with Payday Monsanto when it comes to your music end of your artistry.
Yeah, absolutely. Payday is a very, very good friend of mine, dear brother of mine, and Pay is my engineer. He has mixed and mastered all four of the albums I've put out within the last 2 years, and he has a new record himself coming out, God willing, by the end of the year, and I'll be featured on that as well. And the new record I'm currently in the middle of writing, Pay will be working on that one also.
Excellent. He's also a good friend of Renegade Broadcasting, by the way.
Excellent.
Yes. So let's get into your information when it comes to Latin America. You did a show a while back that it made an impression on me that is long lasting that I still remember. And it had to do with Guatemala and the United Fruit Company.
Yes, United Fruit is known by, I would say, a lot of people within the ranks of the so-called anti-war movement and all of these left-wing, anti-imperialist, communist, socialist-type groups and spaces. And that's because it was popularized by Noam Chomsky. And everybody knows what a lying, scheming, dirty, disingenuous devil Noam Chomsky is on a multitude of different levels. And we can add United Fruit to his devilry as well. United Fruit is not merely an imperialist company that represents Anglo-American interests and what we could call the empire's destabilization of so-called third world countries. This is just a mask. And not to be ironic, but a mask of Zion. That's really what it is. United Fruit was run by a man named Samuel Zemuri, who was your prototypical Yahudi or Jewish immigrant. He came to America and he made a multitude of money involved with petty theft, petty crime, a little bootlegging, as all of these Jews who came to the States were. They were involved in all types of gangsterism. And eventually he made enough money to take over United Fruit. But before that, he owned his own banana company before it was bought by United Fruit, and then he bought United Fruit itself. And from as early as 1910, so we're going back 106 years, this person was involved in destabilization, coups, regime change, etc. He helped overthrow the democratically elected government of Honduras. And then when you fast forward about 45 years, 44 years to be exact, he was involved in the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala. So again, this has always been presented, right, as an American CIA imperialist regime change operation. But when you look at who was the driving force, who was the heavy hand, it was Zemuri and United Fruit. And this is where the plot thickens. Zemuri was not just one of these money-grubbing yidlings who simply wanted to make his dough off of the goyim and then move along his merry way. This was a person who was involved at the upper in the upper echelons of the schemes of international Jewry. This man is one of the founders of the usurping Zionist entity. Every drop of money that he made from exploiting the Guatemalan people, the Honduran people, and many other Central and South American peoples throughout his tenure at United Fruit, he took all of that dough and used it to finance settlements as well as arms transfers to the Jewish terrorists who brought forth the Nakba in Palestine. Mm. So there is this nexus between Jewish criminal activity within Latin America, beginning with the godfather of it all, Samuel Zemuri and United Fruit, and the birth of this filthy, cancerous tumor in Palestine, in the heart of the Arab and Islamic world that we call Israel. So this really was the map. It was the blueprint laid out for every single regime change operation that came thereafter, whether it was Brazil, whether it was Argentina, whether it was Chile, all the way up to today with Brazil yet again, the coup in Honduras against Manuel Zelaya and many of the failed coup attempts against the late, great Hugo Chavez. Everything begins with Zemuri. And what's so astounding to me, my dear brother, is that the way that Zemuri is depicted amongst the Yahud themselves is that he was this conflicted person who did bad things, they say, on the one hand to the Guatemalan, Honduran, and other Latin American goyim, but he was this wonderful person who cared about people on the other hand. And why is that? Because he helped smuggle many Yahud who were fleeing Germany and other German-held areas during the Jewish fratricidal war that we refer to as World War II. And this is also a very key element of the depth of Jewish depravity in the Latin American sphere, because the person who Zemeri contacted in bringing these Jews from Europe was none other than Rafael Trujillo, who was the dictator of the Dominican Republic, and he was also brought to power in a CIA Mossad coup. And he was also a good friend, and I would argue, a client of Samuel Zemeri. So when you think of all of these dictatorships that came to power, whether it was Honduras in 1910, the dictatorship and the utterly subversive regime that came to power in Guatemala, which I'm sure we'll expound upon in just a minute, in 54, and even Trujillo himself, the bloody dictator of the Dominican Republic, all of these people, yes, they indeed did have ties with the CIA. Yes, they did indeed have ties to the American regime before I guess we could classify it as a ZOG, but they were beholden to Samuel Zemeri, the Jewish Zionist banana king, first and foremost.
So with that being a catapult type of scenario over in the Latin American region, what else transpired after Guatemala and the Central American region?
Well, this to me is one of the great tragedies of the last century. And again, when you hear it, we can't sit here and pretend, because it would be erroneous for us to declare such a thing. We can't declare that, well, it's never talked about, because it is talked about. It absolutely is talked about. But again, it's spoken of by a lot of these lefty, commie, anti-war types who are totally toothless, and they're totally Judeophilic. So they will not touch the issue, as Brother Payday and I like to say, the IZJ issue. Because, you know, when you come to this awakening, right, you start with, yeah, Israel, they do a lot of nasty, nasty things. And then you come to the realization, well, it's not really just Israel. It's more of a global problem with the Zionist lobbies and everything else. And then you come to the final realization that it's not just the Israeli entity. It's not just Zionism, but it's also Judaism as a whole with all of its supremacy. So they won't touch any of these things because they're always afraid of being called anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, fascist, or whatever the whatever other Jewish buzzword they like to use to smear people.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened in Guatemala was not only a tragedy in the humanitarian sense, a tragedy of the highest and most disturbing order. But it was another genocide. And I really don't like using that word, because even that word has origins in Judaic discourse. But in the modern sense, that's what it was. It was mass murder of the indigenous people of Guatemala. 300,000 indigenous people were slaughtered by a regime that was led by Efrain Rios Montt, a war criminal in every sense of the word. And you always hear people speaking about Montt as a tool of the CIA. And again, he absolutely did have ties to Langley. But when you look at who backed him militarily, politically, culturally, it was the usurping Zionist regime. Montt's entire security apparatus was in fact trained by Mossad, by Amman, which is Israeli military intelligence. And he even had torture experts from Shin Bet come over to Guatemala, much like the American occupation forces in Iraq were trained by Shin Bet in torture techniques used on the Palestinian and Lebanese people. And over the next couple of decades, they would wipe out 300,000 individuals. And they would always accuse them of being communists. They would accuse them of being people who are in the pay of the Soviet Union. And undoubtedly, if again we're being historically accurate, many of them did indeed receive aid from the Soviet Union. Make of that what you will. But that wasn't the case for everyone. That wasn't the case for most people by any means. The vast majority of the people who were slaughtered were not Marxist communist guerrillas with ties to the Judeo-Soviet Union, but they were regular indigenous people who were rejecting, and again, I know, my dear brother, you wanted to get into this very heavily, the neoliberal policies of Montt, which were indeed neoliberal before it had that name. He was gobbling up all of the nationalized industries that Jacobo Arbenz had taken back from the previous tools in power, who again were clients of Samuel Zemuri, and he began to give back to the poor. Because Guatemala, of course, like Bolivia, is an almost exclusively indigenous country. You don't really have a lot of people from the European and crypto-Jewish settler class like you do in, say, Brazil or Venezuela, Argentina, or even Ecuador. It's predominantly indigenous. So Arbenz was giving back to the indigenous people. Montt reversed that. And anybody who even voiced discontent about it, simply put, they were slaughtered like animals.
Can you explain exactly what neoliberalism actually is to our audience?
Well, I mean, if we're getting down to the absolute simplest explanation, neoliberalism is hyper-privatization. It is the, as well as austerity measures. Austerity measures are inflicted on the absolute poorest of the poor in any country. And we see that happening right here in America. The poorest of the poor in this country, contrary to what our leftist friends like to ram down our throats constantly, are not in fact black folk, are not in fact Latino folk, but white folk. We're talking about the poor white people of Kentucky and throughout the breadbasket of the country who literally don't even have a pot to piss in. And they're the ones bearing the brunt of the economic savagery of Obama. Well, the same thing goes for Latin America. Neoliberalism is the implementation of measures that take anything and everything that is beneficial to the public and subsequently makes it subservient to international capital. And when we talk about international capital, what we really mean is the banksters. What we mean is all of the Jewish banking families that have been at the heart of this New World Order system for the last several hundred years. We mean the Rothschilds. We mean the Warburgs. We mean the Schiffs. We mean the Saffrons. These are the people who truly control the IMF, the World Bank, the European Bank of Reconstruction and Development, the International Bank of Settlement. These are the institutions that stick their claws into third world, or what I prefer to call global South countries, and even global North countries in the West. And they take away their sovereignty. They suck the lifeblood out of the country, and they make them so subservient on international capital and foreign aid that they will never, ever, ever be independent again. And the godfather of neoliberalism is, in fact, Milton Friedman.
Yes, sir. And, University of Chicago.
That's right. And Milton Friedman, of course, is arguably one of the most malevolent Yahud in the entire global Dajjalic system of international Jewish control. And it's his financial ideas that are literally ravaging the vast majority of the countries, not only in Latin America and not only in the global South, including the Middle East. My own homeland of Iraq just signed their death warrant by accepting a loan from the IMF. This is what neoliberalism is. It's taking a country that is sovereign or even semi-sovereign or what I guess we could call transitional. You know how you plant organic seeds and then it takes maybe a year or two before they're fully considered organic? Mm-hmm. Same principle. Countries that are attempting to get out of the debt and make themselves sovereign, the neoliberal controllers, regime changers, and warmongers, they move in and they make sure that that absolutely doesn't happen.
So with that, let's shift over to Chile now with what happened with Allende and Pinochet and Kissinger and the Chicago Boys and the IMF.
Yeah. This, to me, and I know, my brother, you and I have talked in private over the last couple of weeks that there are many persons who look at Marxism and they look at communism and they rightfully see this cancerous, subversive Jewish supremacist threat that if it's allowed to fester, like Takfirism that we're seeing in the Arab Islamic world today, then it can become very, very destructive to a society. But Salvador Allende, to me, wasn't really a Marxist. I know that he identified as a socialist and maybe he held certain Marxist economic ideas, but if you take a look at his policies, they were a lot less like Marxists in the Soviet Union and a lot of what I consider to be Soviet-occupied countries in Eastern Europe. And they were really more along the lines of what we could call national socialism.
Yes, sir.
They weren't really this internationalist idea that we saw with so many communist movements. Who I like to look at is Thomas Sankara, who was the great revolutionary of Burkina Faso. This was a person who did, in fact, identify openly as a Marxist, as a communist, but his version of Marxist communism wasn't internationalized to the point where he was taking aid and making himself subservient to the Yahud controlling Moscow. It was National Socialism. So Allende wanted to take Chile out of the sphere of influence of what was known back then, and I still think it's applicable today. We just have to add a zog in the middle. The Washington Consensus. He wanted Chile to be an independent country. And Henry Kissinger, who, as we know, said that he cares about two things in this world, his family and Israel comes first. Kissinger moved in, took the measures, got all of the authority that he needed from the president and the vice president, and literally unleashed CIA hell on Chile. And if you dig deeper into it, the Mossad absolutely played a role in bringing Pinochet to power as well, because of the fact that Allende was very close to Castro. And at the time, Castro was very close to Syria, and Cuba had actually sent forces to aid the Syrian Arab army against Israel during the 73 war. So it's very, very interesting that this happened. Allende is overthrown, 9/11/73. And then just a month later in Syria, despite everything that happened in Chile, Castro still goes ahead and sends forces to Syria. So what the Israelis were very worried about was that, especially considering the amount of Palestinian people in Chile. A lot of people don't know this, but there's over 500,000 Palestinian, the descendants of Palestinian refugees in Chile today. And at the time, I guess if we're doing the math, maybe it was half of that. So the Israelis were tremendously concerned that a revolutionary regime in Chile would then become a conduit for the Palestinian cause. So they absolutely aided their tribalist cohort, Kissinger, and the CIA in absolutely eviscerating Allende's government. And then, of course, there was just this massive campaign of bloodshed, disappearances, massacres, killings. And maybe the most prominent among them, of course, is Pablo Neruda, who is arguably the most beloved poet of our time. And even he wasn't spared by the madness of Pinochet.
And you know who was spared? The leader of the Communist Party, who happened to be a Jew, by Pinochet. Oh, it's the communists. We got to eliminate them. But then he spares the leader of the Communist Party in Chile.
That's exactly right, my brother. And what I find so astounding about what happened in Chile then, and what we see happening in Latin America today, is that the tactics were exactly the same not only and allow me to amend my comment, not only in Latin America, but also in the Arab Islamic world, vis-a-vis the Arab Spring, the same tactics. And when many so-called leftists and communists, and again, this is for so-called alt-right brethren and those who are so militantly anti-Marxist, and again, I say that with good reason and rightfully so, I am as well, but they can't see the forest for the trees, and they don't understand that the left-right paradigm, which is a Judaic construct to begin with,
doesn't
hold any weight. It doesn't hold any weight. One can hold so-called left-wing ideas, so-called right-wing ideas, so-called centrist ideas, and ideas that don't fit within this controlled, contrived spectrum simultaneously. And it doesn't make you fall into one camp or the other, or make you a Jew plant or a Jew agent or anything of the sort, right?
Right.
So you look at how they took Allende down. They started with protests in the streets. They started with so-called workers' rebellions. They started with certain factions of the military declaring themselves breakaways from the regime. This is exactly what we saw happening in Syria, exactly what we saw happening in Libya. This is what we saw in Iran when they overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953. It's the same platform. And the reason why is not because this person was a communist. In fact, if you go back and look at communist literature, and you know, it's so funny because the communists are so militantly anti-religion based on the writings of the Talmudic Jew Marx. But at the same time, they hold steadfastly to their own dogma a lot more than a lot of religious folks do. And there are more sects of Marxists and communists and socialists than there are in any religion that I know of. So you had many, many factions of so-called communists and so-called Marxists and socialists actually backing the people in the street protesting against the democratically elected Allende. And when you saw Pinochet come to power, he wasn't merely cleansing the country of commies and Marxists. He was cleansing the country of any commie and any Marxist who had ideas that focused on the central theme of we want to be independent. If you are independent, that means that you're against the Israeli-American project for the region, and you have to go. And you know, that brings me to this, my brother, and then I'll keep quiet. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, and you and I were speaking about the Hezb just before we came on air. And they are indeed a point of light in a world that has been Judaized to the point of near absolute darkness. They are the ones who resisted and liberated Lebanon in 2000. They lent their hands to the Palestinian Mukawama, the Palestinian resistance, throughout the Second Intifada, and they helped liberate Gaza, and of course they defeated Israel in combat during the July War of 2006, and now they're standing against Israel's Takfiri project. Sayyid Nasrallah gave a speech many years ago, it's 2013, and he's reiterated this point several times since then, that the Israelis and the Americans, who he described as one hand, you really don't know where Israel ends and where America begins, because the Zionist influence is so deep in America and in the West, generally speaking. It doesn't matter if you identify as a fascist, as a communist, as a Muslim, as a Christian, as a religious person, as a non-religious person. None of it matters. It matters about the project. If you stand with Israel and America, you're good. If you don't, you're no good. And that's the essence of it.
Beautiful. And we will be back after a short break, everybody.
Say. If you enjoy listening to Renegade Broadcasting, but are not also reading Renegade Tribune, you're missing out. We have some of the most insightful and hard-hitting authors from the past and present, covering some of the most taboo and controversial subjects. The Tribune is something you'll want to check out every single day. Perhaps you have what it takes to be an author. Sign up and submit your piece. Join us at RenegadeTribune.com.
It's unfortunate that when we feel a storm, we can roll ourselves over, 'cause we're uncomfortable. Oh, where the devil makes us sin, but we lie. My love for the ones that feel.
Welcome back, everybody, and this is Circus Maximus. Jonathan, let's shift over to Brazil now. Let's talk about past and present.
Yeah, you know, this was another thing. Brazil, to me, is another point of history that is not sufficiently studied enough. Especially, I think, that it needs to be studied by Arabs and Muslims to fully understand what's happening with the Arab Spring today. Because the same way that you saw all these idiotic, colonized house Arabs and house Muslims jump on the bandwagon of the Arab Spring when they saw people demonstrating in the street without ever asking the question, where is the dough coming from? Where is the media attention coming from? Why are they getting media attention? The same thing goes with what happened in Brazil in 1964. Now, what's so interesting about this, my dear brother, is that initially you had various factions of the Brazilian government collaborating against João Goulart. And it's tremendously interesting to me because many of the people who were against Goulart, who again, even though he's painted by right-wing types as a communist, he absolutely wasn't. He was more like a socialist democrat. He had no ties to the Soviet Union to really speak of. Diplomatic ties, of course, but the kind of ties that a lot of left-wing guerrilla groups in Africa, say, had, absolutely not. Or again, a lot of those Eastern European vassal states that were controlled by the Jews, the Bolshevik Jews in Moscow. He didn't have that. The man simply wanted to make Brazil an independent country. And when we think about Brazil on a trans-historical level, who were the first people who settled in Brazil? You always hear about white Portuguese or white Spaniards, but this absolutely wasn't the case. The first people who settled in Brazil were, in fact, Portuguese and Dutch Yahud. And these Portuguese and Dutch Jews brought slavery to what we know today as Latin America, most prominently Brazil and Suriname. And a lot of these slaves were Muslim, and there were many slave rebellions. And Brazilians really need to look into that, as do Muslims and Arabs, so they know who the real controllers are. So anyway, back to the point. In 1964, the conflict had come to a head between these varying forces who opposed Goulart, and they were all different types. They were right-wing types in the military. They were leftists. They were communists. They were liberals. Pretty much anyone who wanted to get down on their knees and perform for the American-Israeli project, they were totally cool with it. Now, when you look into it from the anti-war, anti-imperialist perspective, you always see them talking about the CIA. And indeed, the CIA had a multitude of agent provocateurs on the payroll. And for all of the Arabs and Muslims who may be listening, or who will be listening once this show becomes available, People were protesting in the street. They claimed to be workers. They claimed to be oppressed by the regime. And when the documents were declassified many years later, it turns out they were all agent provocateurs. Every single one of them. Specifically, the one that pops in my head, was the Sailors' Revolt. This was very important because the man, his name, was Cabo. Cabo and Selmo, he was the leader of this revolt of sailors in the Brazilian Navy, which proved to be very, very pivotal. It was almost like the death blow to the Goulart government. And it turns out he was an agent provocateur on the payroll of the CIA. But this is the kicker, my brother. It wasn't until the phone company of Brazil, which at the time was known as ITT. ITT was a privately held company, which was kind of sitting on the fence about the coup. And one thing that the CIA could not do was get access to Goulart, because he did have some loyal folks around him, including loyal members of the army and the security apparatus that would protect him until the very end. Well, Goulart then talked about nationalizing the phone company, ITT. And then the owner of ITT, a devilish, subversive, supremacist yiddling by the name of Harold Janin, a very prominent Jew within the American Jewish community, who had split citizenship between Brazil and the United States, he made a direct call to the director of the CIA at the time, who was John McCone, if memory serves me correctly. The CIA got all of the access that they needed from the phone company, began spying on Goulart to get his location, and within only a matter of weeks, Goulart was overthrown. Now, the reason why this is so significant is because at the same time, while Brazil's national phone company had turned against Goulart, it was also Brazil's national media, led by Globo, which has played such a prominent role in the coup against Dilma Rousseff. And Globo is owned by the Marinho family, which is also a gang of crypto Jews who had ties within the transatlantic slave trade. So you had a prominent Jew in the phone company and a prominent family of Jews in the media antagonizing, facilitating, egging on the unrest against Goulart, which ultimately resulted in the coup.
So then at that point, what ended up taking place after the coup?
Well, my brother, I mean, this is pretty much a rerun of what happened in Guatemala, what happened in Argentina. Inshallah, we'll be able to touch on that as well. What happened in Chile with Pinochet coming to power and the disappearances, the mass killings. The same thing took place in Brazil. A military dictatorship came to power, very close to the United States, very close to Israel, and coincidentally enough, very, very close to none other than United Fruit. And the purges of Brazil, of Brazilian opposition began. Again, it didn't matter whether you identified as a nationalist, if you were one of the many indigenous groups in Brazil that opposed the privatization of their lands, including the very resource-rich and ancient wildlife-rich, water-rich lands of the Amazon. Whether you were a communist, whether you were a Marxist, it didn't matter. If you opposed the regime and if you opposed its neoliberal plans for making Brazil a slave state of the Washington Consensus and really the Rothschild Empire via the IMF and the World Bank, you were killed. You were tortured or you were imprisoned. And that brings us to the modern era with Dilma Rousseff, who actually endured torture under this regime. And, you know, it shows you the kind of people that we're dealing with. And I use that word people in a very, very loose way, because these are not people. These are parasites.
Yes.
Some of the members of the putschists who led the coup against Dilma Rousseff, they openly dedicated, imagine this, my brother, they openly dedicated their overthrow of Dilma to the generals of the military dictatorship that tortured her. I can't even wrap my head around that. And the same people that were at the forefront of dislodging Gulat also helped dislodge Dilma. Globo has been predominantly blamed by all types of Brazilians, again, communists, Marxists, nationalists, indigenous rights activists, etc., etc. So the same people in all of the lesser media companies, which are also owned by Jews and crypto Jews, they were a very key point in overthrowing Dilma. And then when you look at the protest groups that were involved in the coup itself, some of the leaders of it were Hillel, Hazit Hanuar, I can't pronounce it properly, and I'm not going to make the attempt to pronounce it properly. Hebrew is absolutely hideous. And then there's also Habanim Dror. These are the three major Jewish student unions in Brazil. They were all leaders of the protest movement against Dilma. And then the two biggest ones were the Free Brazil Movement, which sounds much like the Free Syrian Army, the gang of Takfiri head choppers in Syria, as well as Vem Pra Rua, which literally translates to the street. And these people were funded by none other than Demon. He really does look like an alien from a reptilian planet, the bloodsucker George Soros. Through his Open Society Institute, he backed these groups. There was also support from USAID and NED, which we know are absolutely infested with Jewish neocons.
And USAID is also a CIA front as well. Wherever they're at, the CIA is involved as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the same thing goes for the NED, which was founded by an ex-CIA agent, also a Jew, Alan Weinstein. So the NED, the USAID, Open Society Institute, several Jewish student groups, I mean, an Israeli by the name of Ilan Goldfein, who was a settler in occupied Haifa, took over Brazil's central bank and also began implementing what we're talking about, neoliberalism, these harsh austerity measures that increase the retirement age. It cuts spending. It obliterates things that the Brazilian government has always done for its people, like healthcare and like taking care of the poor. All of these things are going out the window while the rich are literally diving in like vultures and hyenas. And something else that I think is very, very important. When you think about the deception and the manipulation that goes into these regime change plots, we saw data being pumped out by Globo, as well as the American media as well. Of course, the American media is completely Zionist controlled, totally Judaically influenced from top to bottom. And the Jewish media here was absolutely egging it on, and they were basing it on data from a company called Store Smarts, which is an Israeli company. And when you hear that phrase, Israeli startup, you always think of the so-called Israeli startups during Mossad's attack on 9/11. All of these companies that were started by ex-Mossad, ex-Shin Bet, ex-Aman, ex-IOF, people that worked within the Israeli sphere of technology. All of these are intelligence gathering operations. And it was Store Smarts, which was providing the data on the so-called million-strong protest movement against Dilma. In reality, maybe there were tens of thousands. And in fact, the supporters for Dilma far exceeded the supporters of the coup, at least 10-1. But we never saw that on the media. So Dilma faced the same forces that dislodged Gulat. And I mean, let there be no illusions, my dear brother. Dilma does not go without blame, even though the woman was not guilty of any of the things that the coup plotters accused her of. In fact, one of the coup plotters, Edward Cunha, maybe the biggest parasite of them all, this clown actually was involved in corruption, and he had all kinds of graft inquiries on his person because he had Swiss bank accounts where he was laundering money. And this was one of the men, what maybe the leader, leading the coup against Dilma. So while she was not guilty, she did a very poor job of fighting off the coup, especially with so much support. And contrary to what she said in the interview with RT and elsewhere, this was not an internal coup. It was a Zionist CIA NED coup from A to Z.
And then I also provided you, or you actually found it on your own, the article related to what's going on in Guatemala today as well with the power company controlled by an Israeli company.
Yeah, this I think is a very astounding situation, my brother, because again, it shows you that this is not a problem of Anglo-imperialism. I mean, obviously, the old guard of those Freemasonic Anglo families, they still have clout, they still have power, and they still do have some sort of depth within the CIA. But the American government no longer operates by American Anglo interests. The American government operates by Jewish interests because every American politician is controlled by Jewish money. And going back even to the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, this was not founded by Anglo-Americans. It was founded by many a subversive Jew.
You mean it wasn't the Nazis that came over?
No, my brother, believe it or not, it wasn't the Nazis or the Germanic death cult that started the CIA. Contrary to what Mr. Alex Jones Stein would have us all believe. So this is very, very important because it shows that, yes, there are still imperial interests. No one is denying that. But imperial interests are far exceeded, far outweighed by Jewish Zionist interests. And we see that the Israelis, and really just the Jews in general, going back to the time of United Fruit and Samuel Zemuri, all the way up to the Israeli backing of the genocidal maniac, Mont, the Israelis have an absolute interest in maintaining control, dominion, and neoliberal domination of Latin America. But to me, my brother, what stood out about what's going on in Guatemala with this despicable and parasitic Israeli power company is that the Guatemalan people are rising up and they have been using imagery of Isa, Jesus Christ, alayhi salam, who is considered Messiah and Son of God for our Christian brothers and the second most important prophet in Islam and the Messiah for we Muslims. And they're saying that just like the Jews killed me, just like the Pharisees put me up on the cross, the Jews are killing us today with the deprivation of power. This to me is astounding because it shows that the Jews know there is this continuum between the oppressed people of Latin America. There's a term in Arabic that we use. It's mustazafin. Mustazafin represents the oppressed. So there's this continuum between the mustazafin of Latin America and the mustazafin of the Arab Islamic world. And the Jews so desperately want to create a schism between Muslims and Christians and prevent this Islamic Christian unity. So I feel that while you won't read this in books, it's just my own analytical understanding of the matter. The Jews have maintained a heavy hand in Latin America, going back to the slave trade days of the transatlantic slave trade, because they want to maintain this clash of civilizations between Christianity and Islam, and where they cannot foment that clash of civilizations as they're doing so in the West today with Islamophobia on the one hand and mass immigration and Wahhabism on the other hand. They do it by keeping a divide between oppressed people so they don't link up and form some kind of synthesis.
Excellent. And then we've got about 10 minutes for this segment until we hit a break. Did you want to go over to Argentina or did you want to go to Venezuela?
Well, I guess my brother will kind of have to tie everything in together. I mean, because I think that for those who want to know, they can dig into this information on their own. But the models that we have laid out in Chile, in Guatemala, and Brazil, the same thing really applies to Argentina. You know, it was 76. Again, if memory serves me correctly, where Isabel Perón was overthrown by this military junta, totally backed by the CIA and the Mossad, and organized Jewish interests. And then what came to be known as the Dirty War that lasted from the overthrow of Isabelita, as the Argentinian people called her. They overthrew Isabelita, they replaced it with a military junta, and then for the next 9 years, something in the neighborhood of 30 to 50,000, depending on where you look at your statistics, they were disappeared. Murdered, disappeared, thrown in mass graves. Maybe they were put in secret prisons and they rotted there. God knows best, but that's how many people disappeared. And then when we fast forward to the modern era, where you see Cristina Kirchner, who is a firebrand of a woman, she went to war with the IMF. She went to war with this utterly filthy neocon Jew by the name of Paul Singer, who's a hedge fund gazillionaire, a very big funder of varying forms of degeneracy in America, from faggotry to lesbianism to transgenderism. And it's amazing that he identifies as a person of rightist persuasion, but he's involved in this, which shows you how chameleonic the Yahud are. And it also shows you how the right-left paradigm doesn't mean anything.
Right.
Because the Jews do what the Jews are going to do for the Jews. It's very, very simple.
Yes.
So the government in Argentina was aligning itself with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they established this memorandum of understanding where they would get to the bottom of what happened at the AMIA Jewish Community Center in 1994, which was erroneously blamed on the Islamic Republic of Iran, and which was erroneously blamed on Hezbollah. More than likely, the reason for the bombing was the Mossad did it. And the Mossad has had a history of attacking Jews when it benefited their strategic and geopolitical interests. Whether you look at the bombings of the Iraqi Jewish community, the Moroccan Jewish community, the Yemeni Jewish community, or even the Jews that were allegedly killed in the Mossad raw false flag on November the 26th of 2008 in Mumbai. So it's a very, very likely, I would say very strong likelihood that Mossad did this to break the relationship that was burgeoning between Iran and Argentina at the time. And then when Cristina Kirchner signed the agreement with Iran to get to the bottom of it, the Jews really kicked in their regime change operations, as well as the heavy lobbying to get Cristina Kirchner overthrown. And as much as I hate to say it, the devil succeeded, because Cristina's successor was beaten in the election by Mauricio Macri. And it's my understanding that there was a lot of voter fraud, but the empire prevailed in this instance again. So we're again seeing this in Brazil, is within Venezuela as well. You know, the monsters long tried to get rid of Hugo Chavez, and Hugo, may God rest his soul, who was a true national socialist and a true friend of the Mustazafin. The monsters attempted to overthrow Hugo. They failed. They dislodged him temporarily, and the people literally willed him back into power, subhanAllah. I get the chills just thinking about it. I've never seen anything like it in my entire life, and even reading history, I've never seen anything like what happened in Venezuela in April of 2002. But now, because Nicolas Maduro, who I believe is a righteous man, and I believe he is also a national socialist, and if you read Maduro's comments at Comandante Chavez's funeral, he spoke about the Pharisees. So this is a person who also has an anti-Judaic consciousness, just like Hugo did. But because Maduro doesn't have that same strength, that same charisma, and unifying ability as Hugo, he is very, very vulnerable for a coup. And you don't have to take Jonathan Azaziah's word for it or Nick Spiro's word for it, ladies and gentlemen. All you have to do is look at the Washington Post, which has long been the mouthpiece of the CIA and the Mossad. Whenever they want to leak or dump a story, they put it right there. And the Washington Post is already saying that there will be a so-called people's uprising by the end of the year. So Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution changed so much in Latin America. It literally turned the Israeli-American tide in the region back at least 10 years. Well, that's how long the empire has been out of control, since 1999. And then Rafael Correa in Ecuador and the wonderful Evo Morales in Bolivia have also been in power for a decade, a little give or take. So the monsters have been out of the driver's seat for 10 years, and they're striking back now with the very, very same tactics that they used to overthrow Arbenz in 54, Goulart in 64, Allende in 73, and Perón in 76. Same exact tactics.
And I'm seeing the media blaming the Venezuelan government for not utilizing their resources properly and using power stations with water. And there's a drought going on, and how they put all their eggs in one basket by using water-fueled power stations, and how they could have done so much differently, and how they're rationing off food where they've got all these resources. So it sounds like they're trying to prop it up again for this neoliberalism. And, hey, you got all these assets. Why don't you guys use them in a better way?
Exactly, my brother. And I know we're running out of time for this segment, so I'll make it brief. Comandante Chavez, he nationalized anything and everything that you could think of. Healthcare, electricity, gold, silver, glass. Anything that the Venezuelan people could produce with their bare hands, as well as other crops, Hugo nationalized it. So while he did so much nationalizing, he eliminated extreme poverty, he eliminated illiteracy, and with the help of doctors in Cuba, he helped modernize Venezuela's healthcare system, and now Venezuelan doctors are among the best in the world. There were many, many other industries, specifically media, in supermarkets and cities. And these people have been hoarding, literally hoarding material to help the pressure on.
Seventy years of propaganda created a public perception of Adolf Hitler as mythical as anything to be found in a Disneyland theme park. Now, thanks to the internet and Amazon self-publishing, we can finally access taboo information. This offers you opportunity to benefit from the respect of others. There is much satisfaction to be had by putting someone right and proving it. Mike Walsh, Third Reich Spin-Free Truth Books, opens up a world of previously blocked information. Especially recommended is Mike Walsh's Witness to History. Go to Amazon Books or Kindle. Check Mike Walsh Witness to History.
This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Circus Maximus on the Renegade Broadcasting Network. I am on the line with Jonathan Azaziah, and we are titling the show The Mask of Zion. How appropriate. And Jonathan, I wanted to give you an opportunity to finish up what you were saying about Venezuela, the nationalization of the assets of the Venezuelan people and how that benefited them and what else Hugo Chavez did for his people.
Oh, I really appreciate it, my brother, because I think it's very, very important that people know. So yes, while Hugo had nationalized all of the things I mentioned just before we went to the break, there were still things that he didn't. And the most important of these things were the media, as well as a lot of the supermarkets. There were some that were nationalized that the government took over, but the focus was really on land and benefiting people who had been in poverty their entire life. And this, of course, were the indigenous peoples, the descendants of slaves in Venezuela, and just lower class poor folk in general. You know, just like Brazil, and really in all of Latin America, when you look at the slave owners, those who operated the transatlantic slave trade, and as well as the conquistadors, all of these people were Marranos. All of these people, or the vast, vast majority of them, were and are crypto Jews. So when you hear a lot of Latin American folk talking about the white European class of Latin America, it's very false. It's more the crypto-Jewish colonialist class that remained. Hugo overthrew that crypto-Jewish colonial class. And if you notice, the Jewish population from the time Hugo got into power until the time that he passed away, or some would argue was murdered by the CIA and the Mossad, it decreased by over 50%.
Same with the Chilean population of Jews. A lot of them left when Allende was actually in office, and then a lot of them came back when Pinochet was in power.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So again, this should tell people, when you hear a lot of these fools saying that Comandante Chavez or even Mr. Allende were crypto-Marxists, or even they say Marxist commie tools of the Jews, it's all nonsense. It's all nonsense and based on ignorance. So because Hugo didn't go after the media, and because Hugo did not go after some of these supermarkets, what we're seeing today is economic war waged on Maduro and Venezuela as a whole by the crypto-Jewish colonial class, which is tied to their ethnic brethren in the United States, as well as the neocon-dominated State Department. When we look at the people who had it out for Hugo, the two people that come to mind are yet again two neocon Zionist Jews. Otto Reich, who was a part of the neocon dirty wars in El Salvador and in Nicaragua, and the dirty war in Argentina during the 80s. And none other than Elliot Abrams, who of course has played a devilish role in pretty much any global South state you can think of. When a Republican was in the White House, he was there engaged in all kinds of despicable criminal behavior.
He's also part of the Project for a New American Century, too, wasn't
Bingo.
He?
Bingo, bingo. So Abrams and Reich had it out for Hugo, and to this day, they're still working day and night to overthrow the Bolivarian Revolution. So what these elites are doing in Venezuela, these descendants of the colonialists that fought Hugo's hero and inspiration, Simon Bolivar, they are literally hoarding basic goods, and because they own so much land and they own warehouses and businesses, they are taking toilet paper and vegetables and paper towel and cleaning goods and just basic foods and just storing it away in warehouses and buried underneath their lands just to create an economic crisis.
So you have these alt-righters on Twitter, you have a lot of your conservative Republicans saying, hey, this is Venezuela. Do you want America to turn into this if you vote for Hillary? This is what they're using as an example right now in the Twitter sphere.
This is despicable because this would never happen in America, because what's happening in Venezuela is not the incompetence of Nicolas Maduro. I mean, we have to take into consideration that Maduro was chosen by Hugo, mm-hmm. which means that Hugo, who was beloved by the Venezuelan people, who was trusted by Gaddafi, who was trusted by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who was trusted by Ahmadinejad, as well as Ayatollah Khamenei himself in the Islamic Republic of Iran, who Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who never calls out world leaders, saluted personally during the 2006 July war because of Comandante Chavez's solidarity with Lebanon. I mean, this is a man who was trusted and beloved by the entire oppressed, anti-Zionist, anti-imperialist world. And simply put, he knew what the hell he was doing. Mm-hmm. And Maduro was with him every step of the way. Maduro was one of his top lieutenants. But the war on Maduro, I think, may be even fiercer than the American-Israeli attempts to get rid of Hugo. So all of this economic chaos and the chaos in the streets, every drop of it is orchestrated by the CIA, the Mossad, and their tools in all different sectors. So these comparisons that are being made, my brother, they're just asinine, to be very, very blunt.
Agreed. Now, we've covered Latin America pretty extensively, and there's a lot of information out there that everybody can do their own research. This show is definitely a good starting point for beginners. There's a lot of information, a lot of names being named. So go off of that. We're going to shift over to the Middle East now. Let's go over to Libya as far as that national socialist regime that Gaddafi had built for his people and benefited his people. Can you talk about all the different things that Gaddafi did for his people?
Oh, certainly, my brother. And I want to make a disclaimer. I am not personally the greatest fan in the world of Muammar Gaddafi. So this, I think, should hit home for a lot of people, because I feel that even if we have a personal dislike for any particular individual, we have to deal with their actions and we have to deal with the information at hand and still be objective about it. I'm not a particular fan of Gaddafi because of his alleged involvement with the disappearance of Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, the great founder of the Lebanese resistance, who disappeared under very, very strange circumstances in 1978.
Do you think that was pinned on him and the information saying that he was involved in that could be inaccurate?
Well, I have thought about that, my brother, but what I find very strange is that Hezbollah and the Ammal movement in Lebanon, which I absolutely can't stand. I have no love whatsoever for Ammal, and I think that the leader of Ammal, while he did wonderful things during the 2006 war, I believe he's a war criminal with the blood of Palestinians and Lebanese Shia, for that matter, on his hands, and he belongs in jail. But anyway, Ammal and Hezbollah invited Gaddafi to come to Lebanon to talk about it. Gaddafi never did. So I guess we have to make of that what we will. What my Libyan friends have told me, and again, this is pure conjecture, I don't know if it's true or not, but they've told me that Gaddafi made a deal with the devil, so to speak, that they would that he would allow Mossad and CIA to kidnap or assassinate Sayyid Musa al-Sadr, and they would allow him to build up Libya. But of course, this backfired when the Israelis launched Operation Trojan Horse, where they spied on Gaddafi, fabricated intelligence, gave it to the Americans, and then Ronald Reagan bombed Gaddafi, nearly killed him, and murdered his daughter. So this is where it went out the window. I don't know if I believe that or not. It is relatively plausible, but I don't have any confirmation of that. So I feel that whatever he did have some kind of role in it, in my personal and educated opinion. But with all that said, Gaddafi was a revolutionary for Africa in every sense of the phrase. There is no doubt about it. Gaddafi, the biggest thing, he wanted to take Africa out of the IMF and World Bank's sphere of influence. And he was actually in the process of doing that by implementing a system, instituting and implementing a system of the silver and gold dirham, gold and silver currency that would strictly be relegated to the African continent. They would take Africa off foreign aid completely. And Gaddafi was ready to commit hundreds of billions of dollars in Libyan oil money to do it. Gaddafi was ready to launch a satellite program that would take Africa out of the French and British telecom networks. Gaddafi was ready to form a real African military union that wouldn't be subservient to the United States as the AU is today. The AU is nothing but a tool of AFRICOM as well as Israel. Gaddafi was also very instrumental in forging Arab and indigenous black African influence within the continent. So he really picked off where Nasser left off. You know, the Jamal Abdel Nasser, the revolutionary leader of Egypt, he formed this wonderful friendship and alliance with Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, who was also, incidentally enough, overthrown by the CIA and the Mossad. And Nasser, incidentally enough, was poisoned by the CIA and the Mossad. Gaddafi wanted to establish this alliance that would be impenetrable for the Jews. And he did that. To a large extent, he did that. And when you look at Libya itself, I mean, they called it the Switzerland of Africa. Now, my personal opinion, I think that's a tad orientalist. I prefer to look at Switzerland as the Libya of Europe, but it's really a tomato or tomato kind of thing. And he gave Libyans free education. He gave Libyans free healthcare. He gave thousands of dollars to expectant mothers. And he even allowed those who would make a family, he would buy them houses. If they could not find a spot in a Libyan program, then Gaddafi would go ahead and finance their studies abroad. And what was so beautiful about the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya in the terms of governance was that it was truly democratic in a revolutionary kind of way, where you didn't have any real state control. What you had were people's committees that governed themselves, and when they needed a very, very big project, yes, of course, they would go to Tripoli and consult with the government. So Gaddafi, while people depict him, and by people, of course, I mean the House Arabs and House Muslims of the Arab Spring, the colonized types, as well as the neocon Jews and any other enemy force that is in league with the neocon Jews. They call Gaddafi a dictator, but he was anything but. And I think that that is perfectly encapsulated when you look at during the height of the war, of the NATO war on Libya, when there were 1.5 million people. Imagine that. Under NATO's savage, utterly barbaric bombardment that was that resembled the Allied bombardment of National Socialist Germany in Dresden, or the Allied bombing, the Allied firebombing of Tokyo, mm-hmm. also during World War II. It was just completely sadistic and monstrous. And yet 1.5 million Libyans went into the street to talk about Gaddafi. And also, maybe the most glaring thing, is that Gaddafi prioritized the Palestinian cause, gave a ton of money into the PLO, and regardless of what the PLO would become, everybody should know that story of collaborationism. But when the PLO was still pure, still righteous, and still a real liberation organization, Gaddafi prioritized that. And unlike so many leaders within the Arab Islamic world, particularly Al Saud and Qatar and the UAE, and especially the absolutely deplorable regime, the Palestinian killing, Yemeni killing regime in Egypt led by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, Gaddafi refused to normalize with Israel, and those were the ultimate reasons why he was killed. African independence and anti-Zionism.
I see from this article from disinfo.com, Libyans had no electricity bill. There was no interest on loans.
Yep.
Newlyweds received $50,000 American dollars by the government to buy their first apartment. Education, medical was free.
Yep.
Literacy rate went from 25% to 83%.
Yes.
If you wanted to go take up a farming career, you would receive farming land, a farming house, equipment, seeds, and livestock to kickstart, all for free. If a Libyan bought a car, 50% was subsidized.
Yep.
Price of petrol, 14 cents per liter. They had no external debt, and its reserves were up to at least $150 billion. Now all of their assets are frozen today.
Bingo.
And, it's, you know, it's kind of like the sanctions on Iran. And the oil sales portion of the profits went to bank accounts of all Libyan citizens. If
that's
you
right.
Had a child, you'd receive 5,000 American dollars. And then the world's largest irrigation project, known as the Great Man-Made River Project.
Yep. And I just wanted to get into that as well, my brother. I wrote several articles on Mask of Zion. They're also on mukawamamusic.net. And alhamdulillah, praise be to God, that they have spread very, very far across the internet, called the Zionist infestation of Africa. And they deal with how deeply the usurping entity has penetrated. And in one of the pieces, I talk about water wars, that when you think of the Yahud, and it's ironic, of course, because the Jews have been poisoning wells for, since time immemorial. And then when they got to Palestine, they polluted the gorgeous running streams, waters, rivers, and even the sea surrounding Palestine, to the point where they needed to take water from elsewhere. And one of the most barbaric crimes of the NATO Zionist war on Libya was the destruction of the Great Man-Made River, which literally brought water from the desert to the Libyan people. I mean, Libya is really just a gigantic desert, and Gaddafi modernized this state and gave people this world-class pH-rich irrigation system that wiped away drought. And I think the literacy, I'm glad that you brought that up because it has slipped my mind. The literacy is so important, because when you think about the Libyan monarchy, which ruled backed by Italian colonialism and British colonialism. And again, just for the record, ladies and gentlemen, when I say colonialism, I do indeed mean Rothschild finance colonialism. That's a very interesting paradigm, which is beyond the scope of this show. But there really was no European colonial activity until the Rothschilds took over European central banks. So you had Rothschild-financed Italian colonialists, Rothschild-financed British colonialists popping up King Idris in Libya, who literally ruled with an iron fist, and he kept the various tribal peoples of Libya literally deaf, dumb, and blind. And Gaddafi, in a matter of only 30 years, he turned the country around in a total 180. So the elimination of Gaddafi was not just an overthrow of Arab African independence. it wasn't just an overthrow of anti-Zionism and anti-colonialism. It was literally the overthrow of progress. And when you see what's taking place in Libya today, it is a Takfiri Wahhabi paradise where all of these ISIS and ISIS-like groups are running around and chopping off people's heads and pillaging the oil, corrupting the other resources, destroying all of the landmarks that were built by Gaddafi. What the Jews did, what the Jews and their Anglo allies did in Libya, they've set the country back 100 years easily.
And Gaddafi also warned, you overthrow me, you're going to see a flood of Africans and other people from the Middle East flooding into Europe.
That's absolutely right. And it's amazing because every single word that came out of Gaddafi's mouth, every word he said on the second day of the protests, this started on February 17th, 2011. On February 18th, Gaddafi said these people are Al-Qaeda, and he said that these people are doped up on some kind of blue pill. And everyone thought that Gaddafi was out of his goddamn mind. And yet the blue pills that these people were doped up on, then they turned up in Syria. They turned up among the Takfiris in Iraq, the Iraqi Mukawama, the Iraqi resistance. They found these blue pills when they liberated the strategic area of Jarf al-Sakhr, which is now known by Iraqis as Jarf al-Nasr. So they changed the name from Rocky Cliff to Victory Cliff. And these blue pills are, in fact, Captagon pills. And the biggest dealers of these Captagon pills, there was a Saudi prince who was arrested in Lebanon, and kudos to Lebanon, which is normally a worthless and corrupt state, and there's nothing good in it except the Hezbollah. But the Lebanese security apparatus has managed to keep this Saudi prince locked up. It turns out that the Saudis have been dealing Captagon pills to their proxies in Lebanon, in Iraq, in Syria, and in Libya. So Gaddafi said that these people were Qaeda. He was right. He said that these people were doped up on drugs, specifically these blue Captagon pills. He was right. He said, you destroy me, you're going to see Wahhabism proliferate all throughout the African continent. He was right, because there have not only been these horrible Takfiri activities in Libya, but also in Nigeria, in Chad, in Burkina Faso, of all places, Cameroon, of all places, the Central African Republic, where there never was any of this nonsense. It exists now because Gaddafi was the bulwark against Saudi influence. And that's another piece of information that we should make clear. Al-Saud hated Gaddafi, hated him. And Gaddafi hated them, because Gaddafi was one of the very few leaders in the Arab world, in the history of the Arab world. The other two among them, of course, al-Nasser and Bashar al-Assad, Dr. Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria today. So everything that Gaddafi said, including about the refugees, has come to fruition. And the worst part of all, and this should really be a sign to all Global South leaders, and I would even say leaders within the West that are emerging, who are approaching things from a national socialist perspective. If you get into bed with the Jews, you know, Gaddafi met with Richard Perle, the Prince of Darkness, the author of the infamous Clean Break document, and one of the neocon architects of the destruction of Iraq, and one of the architects of the New Middle East Project, which is really just an extension of Greater Israel. He met with Richard Perle. Richard Perle said, we're going to revamp your image. Gaddafi gave up his nukes and thought that these people were finally going to be his friends, and they were finally going to leave him alone. And instead, the very same people that he made peace with, like Berlusconi and the disgusting Mossadnik Jew Nicolas Sarkozy, they betrayed him. They threw him under the bus. And they destroyed everything that he built. You get into bed with the Jews, when you get out of bed, you're dead.
There's a quote by George Orwell that I like to reemphasize. The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history.
Absolutely, my brother. Absolutely. And I think that that is that quote from Orwell, who was also ripped limb from limb by the Yahud for being anti-Semitic. That quote is totally applicable today to the Arab and Islamic world that are dealing with this upheaval, this American Zionist psyop that we know as the Arab Spring. And they are buying into it, hook, line, and sinker, as if democracy has come to our region, as if freedom has come to our region, when this same scenario has been played out time and time and time again, not only in Latin America, not only with the overthrow of Mohammed Mossadegh and actually several leaders in Syria in the late 40s and early 50s, not only with a personal hero of mine, Abdel Karim Qasim, the revolutionary leader of Iraq, who overthrew the monarchy on July 14th, 1958, before he was assassinated by the Mossad, the CIA, and a young man, many of you may know his name, by the name of Saddam Hussein, in February of 1963. Every time it starts with these protests, with this soft power, and when the soft power doesn't work, they go to the military option. And they tried this with Gaddafi too. Look up Libya student rebellion, everyone. They attempted to get rid of Gaddafi very, very early on within his tenure, and they failed. And then they attempted to co-opt him, which is what they do with so many leaders. And it looked like everything was going fine, but Gaddafi had this vision of an independent Africa, which didn't jive with international Jewry, and they punished him for it. History repeats itself time and time again. And absolutely, those who are disconnected from it, they won't make it to the future.
And with the Baghdad Museum, I know that Saddam Hussein was trying to build this huge, you know, museum and storing all these artifacts, and it was going to be one of the greatest treasures of the world. And when the American Special Forces came in, the first thing that they did, not a military operation per se, it was more, let's grab these artifacts. And that goes back to controlling history and replacing it with something else. We're seeing that with cultural Marxism. We're seeing that with these so-called ISIS fighters destroying ancient monuments and architecture and history in general from ancient societies.
Yeah, absolutely, my brother. And this bothers me particularly, because all of this is done in the name of Islam. And when you look at the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the peace and blessings of God be upon him and his family, the idols that Muhammad destroyed within the Kaaba, and now this is very, very early Islamic history, he didn't destroy these monuments because they represented mere idol worship. He destroyed them because they were also tools of oppression. The pagan Arabs and the Jewish tribes of the time were using these idols to keep people in the dark and keep them under their jackboot. When you look at what happened after that, once Muhammad had liberated the Kaaba and liberated most of Arabia from these pagan, ignorant Arabs and their Jewish allies, specifically at Khaybar, Muhammad preserved history. Muhammad signed agreements with Christians to preserve their artwork and to preserve their history. And when you look at the great empires of Islam, which all of them I don't agree with politically, specifically because of their persecution of the Shia, but you look at all of these great Islamic empires, they preserved all of this wonderful history, including ancient pagan history. So this is not something that has anything to do with Islam. It has something to do with the Yahud.
Yes. And we're hitting a break here. We'll be back in a couple minutes for the last half hour.
Okay.
You, above everyone else, should understand. We cannot be free until we have power. How else can we achieve it?
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Welcome back, everybody, to Circus Maximus for the last half hour. Jonathan, have you heard of the Codenhoff-Kalergi plan?
I have not, my dear brother. Please enlighten me.
Codenhoff-Kalergi was a count who was one of the movers and shakers and one of the people who were behind the formation of the EU. He wrote a book called Practical Idealism. His thoughts in that book were that the European people will be a mixed race someday, and the Jews of the will be the Western powers, and the Chinese will be the Eastern power in the near future.
Wow.
He was married to a few different Jewesses in his life and was a mover and shaker for the EU. Well, so I think that this Greater Israel plan is a two-edged sword. To on the other end would be the Kalergi plan for Europe as well. So you're eliminating the Arab people over in the Greater Israel sections, and you're also infiltrating or flooding in a lot of the people from that region, and European sellouts are putting out propaganda today showing the people coming into Europe ways of integrating, like to have mixed race relationships. A lot of the propaganda show images of the white European people having intercourse with the peoples from the Middle East and Africa. And they're also having educational courses and counseling sessions with indigenous European people, and they're sitting them down with people from other areas of the Middle East and Africa and courting them and showing them how to interact with one another and how to date.
It's absolutely despicable. And I guess as my dear friend, who I miss every day, Michael Collins Piper, used to say, this is where we bring everything full circle. And I don't believe that anyone has defined neoliberalism in the way that you and I are about to define it. But neoliberalism, I believe, is not merely the economic factor. Neoliberalism also refers to what I call Jewish cultural imperialism.
The cultural Marxism that came from the Frankfurt School.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it is. You had these people, Herbert Marcuse and Horkheimer and Walter Benjamin and this entire gang of degenerates. And that's really what they were. And they came up with these ideas that would come to be known today as identity politics. So instead of the Goyim viewing themselves through principles of nationalism, and that you have your culture and your religion, I have my culture and my religion, but we could come together on the principle of brotherhood to fight this common enemy. Mm-hmm. The Jews instead would divide everyone into groups and subgroups and sub-subgroups and sub-sub-sub-subgroups and pit everyone against each other in a myriad of different ways, whether it's straight versus gay, white versus black, Muslim versus Christian, transgender versus heteronormative, and all of these various degeneracies. So when we take a look at what happened in Iraq, to finish the point that we were attempting to make before the break, the Jews don't have any history. Everything that the Jews have is fabricated. Everything about the so-called kingdoms of Israel, it's mythical. It's literally mythical. But when you look at the Mesopotamian people, the Iraqi people, the Syrian and the Assyrian people, when you look at the Persian people, we all have these wonderful, beautiful, detailed, intimate, intricate histories that the Jews absolutely envy and despise. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, they want to destroy it. And on the other hand, they want to take pieces of it as their trophies. And the same exact thing can be said about the European people. The European peoples, especially the Germanic and Nordic peoples, have these wonderful, glorious, beautiful intellectual histories. And since the Jews can't destroy it militarily in the same way that they're attempting to destroy the Arab and Islamic world, they have to do it in a cultural way, in a subversive way. And this is where Jewish cultural imperialism / cultural Marxism comes in. You disconnect people from their values, their morality. And this is exactly what they did in Iraq. You and I were talking about it just prior to coming on air. One of the first things that the Yahud did is that they ransacked the great theaters of Baghdad, which had film rolls over 100 years old. And this was back in 03-04. So long before there was that putrid house of filth and swill that we know as Jewish Hollywood. You had cinema in Baghdad, you had cinema in Cairo, and the Jews destroyed these original films and they put pornography in there instead. So men who lost their wives, women who lost their husbands, sons and daughters who lost their parents would disconnect themselves from Islam, disconnect themselves from ancient Christianity, and find themselves locked in pornography. And then when we see here in the West, all you need to do is read the famous essay, Triple Ethnic, Ethnics, Exnics in Jewish Quarterly by Samuel Abrams and Nathan Abrams, excuse me. And you can see that pornography in America is Judaic. When you look at who put pornography in Weimar Germany, it was the Jews there as well. Mm-hmm. So all of this filth is meant to disconnect the European people and the Arab Islamic peoples from their history, from their courage, from their morality. And then, my brother, when people have their morality, their minds, their sense of history, and most importantly, their sense of identity completely eviscerated, it becomes very, very easy to pit them against each other.
And manipulate. Yep, absolutely. And I also dropped the bomb on you before the show how Western powers flew drones over North Korea recently, dropping Hollywood films and disk drives of different types of media onto the North Korean people. God knows what is on those discs. I can only imagine probably your pornography as well.
I would certainly agree with that. And again, you have a lot of people within the so-called alternative media, the so-called anti-Judaic media that attack the DPRK as a communist state, but that's just not the case.
They seem more like another national socialist regime.
Absolutely. And if there's a wonderful article, the name of it slips my head, but if you go to any internet search engine and you put in North Korea, Iran, and Asia Times, there is this beautiful, beautiful article. It was so enlightening and so heartwarming to me that showed the spiritual ties between the Islamic Republic of Iran, which is obviously a revolutionary Shia Muslim government, and the DPRK, which is allegedly a communist state, but that's not really the case. They hold on to these ancient Asian spiritual traditions that are rooted, in the same moral code that Islam is. So these are people who are very moral. They're very kept to themselves. They're very modest. They're very, very modest. So when the Jews see that, and the Jews are the most depraved people, the most degenerate people, the most pornographic people. And as Sayyid Nasrallah reminded us many years ago when his son, Sayyid Hadi, was martyred in the fight against the Israeli enemy, the most cowardly people, because they can't fight their battles by themselves. So like the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, famously said, the Jews rule the world by proxy. So because they can't do it with their own two hands, they do it by proxy and via all of these varying degrees of immorality and trash. So the DPRK, which is very closed off because of American Zionist sanctions on the country, because they're very independent, they've been able to keep that moral fiber. And I know that sounds like a strange and almost corny kind of phrase, but it really is applicable here.
It's truth.
Absolutely. They want to erode the moral fiber of the DPRK. So as people become less militant, and the toothlessness and the fanglessness, sets in, then it makes them much easier to conquer. Because if people are open to the ideas of pornography, then whether it's conscious or subconscious, it makes them open to the idea of Jews. And once you accept that paradigm, you're done.
Absolutely. And we've got 20 minutes, so let's cover, you just put out an article related to Yemen. Is that correct?
Yes, my dear brother. You know, Yemen is a particular point of interest for me, and it's not just personal, because one of my closest friends, Ghassan al-Husseini, is Yemeni. He is a journalist with Al-Masira, but he does a lot of freelance work as well, documenting what Al-Saud, on behalf of Israel, has done to Yemen. And I don't think that it's just that personal connection, because him and I go back to New York almost. I met Ghassan, I think, when I was 7 years old. So we've been friends for pretty much my whole life.
Yeah.
But it really is because the Yemeni people, as Sayyid Nasrallah, I don't mean to keep going back to him, but I mean, Nasrallah to me is a point of light and a point of guidance. So a lot of things that, pretty much everything that he says, is something that is of the utmost value and meaning to me. And Nasrallah said that the Yemeni people are the most oppressed people in the world today, and that the war on Yemen has even exceeded the savagery of the Israeli wars on Gaza and Lebanon. This is what the Sayyid himself, the leader of the Lebanese Islamic Resistance, said. And Amnesty International, which is one of the most subversive organs of soft power in the entire network of Empire Judaica's arsenal. Amnesty International put out a piece accusing Ansarullah, a.k.a. the Houthis, of all these human rights abuses against the opposition. And this was tremendously Orwellian language to me, because the opposition that they were referring to was Al-Islah. And Al-Islah is the Yemeni Muslim Brotherhood. And the Yemeni Muslim Brotherhood has been financed by Al-Saud and Qatar for many, many, many decades. And they were allowed to proliferate and spread their Wahhabism all throughout Yemen, literally changing the demographics of Zaydi Shia and Shafi Sunni into predominantly Wahhabi. And on the first day of the war, my brother, and a little background for your listenership, The reason why Saudi Arabia launched this war against Ansarullah wasn't just because Ansarullah had staged this revolution on September 21st, 2014, implementing yet again an Islamic, Arab nationalist, national socialist revolution in the country, thus making Yemen independent and out of the sphere of influence of America, Israel, and crypto-Jewish al-Saud. But in early February and then again in early March, Ansarullah met with Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And it was said that what was discussed at the meeting is that when Ansarullah takes control of Bab al-Mandab, the strategic waterway between Yemen and Eritrea, where much of the world's oil and goods flow in from Asia into the usurping entity and then into Europe, Ansarullah said that they will open this up as a corridor. And when you look at it from a geographical perspective, the map, it's almost an unhindered beeline from the Yemeni side of Bab al-Mandab right to Gaza, that Ansarullah would open up this waterway for the resistance axis, i.e. Hezbollah, the Syrian Arab Army, and Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to smuggle weapons to the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. Well, my brother, on March 25th, Ansarullah liberates Al-Mukha, which is a strategic port city in Taiz, and not even 24 hours after liberating the strategic city with a marine base that overlooks Bab al-Mandab, al-Saud launches the war on Yemen. And on the day that these agents of Satan, Dajjal, and international Jewry invade Yemen, the poorest country in the entire Arab world, al-Isla announces its support not for Ansarullah, i.e. the people who are about to defend the country from invasion, but for Saudi Arabia. So, of course, from the perspective, Ansarullah is the legitimate ruling authority in Yemen. They arrested many of these collaborators and threw them into prison, which they absolutely had the right to do. So Amnesty International instead, they go ahead and describe the Houthis as operating arbitrarily and the fact that they are locking people up without any trial whatsoever. And the reason why this is so important, again, to quote Michael Collins Piper, we bring this full circle, they are propagating not only against the Islamic Arab National Socialist regime of Ansarullah in Yemen, as well as the Arab Nationalist government in Syria led by Bashar al-Assad, but they are also leading the drive against the democratically elected authorities in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and yes, Brazil as well.
So for the people listening, why is it important to compare Latin America with what's going on in the Middle East? Is there a potential, is there any hint towards this happening towards the European people as well? It sounds similar to what's going on in Greece with their austerity measures as well.
Oh, absolutely, my brother, because we have to look at the world, not from a national perspective, but from a national slash international perspective. Yes, you maintain your nationalism, you maintain your sovereignty, but your enemy is also the enemy of every other sovereign indigenous people in the world. And when you look at what's happening in Latin America, it's so much deeper because you have this new Pope, Pope Francis. And I wrote a piece recently, and inshallah khair, you could bring me back on and maybe we can talk about it, because it's a very subversive element. And of course, nobody within the alternative left, the alternative right, the anti-war, the solidarity community, no one is talking about it. But Pope Francis is an agent of the Jews.
Oh yeah.
Absolutely soup to nuts, A to Z, top to bottom, front to back. And the things that he has done, the things that he has said, on behalf of the Jewish community are astounding. And my dear brother and colleague, Mark Glenn, has been asserting for years that the Pope is going to be the agent of international Zionism to implement the Latin Spring. And I don't think at this point you can say that Mark Glenn is anything other than absolutely right when you see the fact that the Pope and the Catholic Church as a whole, which has long been infiltrated by the Alumbrados, the crypto Jews, and all of these various shaitanic secret societies, saying nothing about what's taking place in Latin America on vis-a-vis the democratically elected authorities. Quite to the contrary, he is instead voicing his support for stability, dialogue. In other words, he wants dialogue with the putschists, which is absolutely ridiculous. So in Latin America, the enemy is not imperialism. The enemy is Jewry. And imperialism is merely a tool of Jewry. In the Arab Islamic world, the enemy is not imperialism. The enemy is Jewry, of which Western imperialism is the attack dog, the battering ram being used by the Yahud to colonize our land and re-implement the Greater Israel project that Hezbollah dealt a deathly blow to on May 25th, 2000. And in Europe, the enemy is not Islam. The enemy is not Islam, nor is it the dark peoples who are unfortunately emigrating to Europe from the Arab Islamic world. The enemy is Jewry, which through Western imperialism is driving people outside of their homelands, and then through their liberal politicians who are financed by all of these Jewish billionaires and spearheaded by subversives like that absolutely atrocious creature, Barbara Spector, they are leading the drive for emigration and manufactured multiculturalism in Europe. So from Latin America to Europe, to the Arab Islamic world, all the way to Russia, and I would say even Asia, the enemy is the same. So it's very important for us to understand, first and foremost, our own national, religious, spiritual, cultural, ethnic, racial identities, so we can't be affected and colonized by Jewish cultural imperialism, aka cultural Marxism. And at the same time, we also have to establish a sense of international solidarity, because whether we like it or not, we're all in this together.
And I also know that Israel Aid is right there, right when there's any kind of migrants in the Mediterranean or wherever. They're all over that, and they're making sure that these people are getting to Europe safely.
Yeah, absolutely, which, again, is tremendously astounding, because and it boggles my mind, and I have to tell you, my dear brother, it pisses me off to no end when you see Muslims and Arabs being used as useful idiots by the Jews, the same Jews that are killing you in Palestine and Syria and Lebanon, and that are funding and medically treating and arming and politically covering these takfiris in Iraq and Yemen, Syria and elsewhere. The same Jews who are doing this to you in your homeland, they're going to help you get to Europe? And you don't think that there is even the slightest demonicness to that? And what's so interesting about Israel is that it is also intimately involved in all kinds of so-called aid projects in Africa. I've actually written rather extensively about it in my pieces about the Zionist infestation of Africa. And Israel, they're involved in irrigation. They're involved in crop growing. And they are also involved in, brace yourself, cultural cooperation between the Israeli entity and various African states. So in other words, these ancient African states that either have their own moral tribal traditions, or that are Christian or Muslim. Many are a combination of both Christian and Muslim. The Israelis are looking to erode that culture and replace it with the neoliberal, capitalistic fake multicultural conglomeration, amalgamation, really, that the Jews have created and that they have been forcing on people for, give or take, the last century.
So we got a couple minutes here, Jonathan. I would like you to close out the show and tell our audience whatever it is that you would like to say.
Well, I just would like to make it very clear that you know, the main reason, my dear brother, that you brought me on this program, not just because it was so beautiful and wonderful to for us to reconnect friendship and brotherhood after so many years of being incommunicado, but also to deal with this issue that the left-right paradigm that so many of our brethren, both ideological, ethnic, and cultural on your end as well as my end, cling to. It simply is dead. On every level, it's dead. And you cannot get behind people who are backed by the CIA and Israel and true international Jewish power brokers like Samuel Zemuri with United Fruit and say that, oh, well, the coup is a good thing because you're seeing all of these people who we think are commies being killed. And the same thing applies today to the Arab and Islamic world, where you have people cheering on the death of Gaddafi. People are calling for Bashar al-Assad's head to be on a chopping block. And my entire argument, and obviously I'm a defender of Gaddafi, and I'm a defender and a supporter of Bashar al-Assad in any regime. I look at Hosni Mubarak, the leader of Egypt, who Sayyid Nasrallah called Pharaon, which means Pharaoh, and he considered him to be the worst of the worst. Even Hosni Mubarak, this filthy, traitorous collaborator who had oppressed the Egyptian people and oppressed the Palestinian people and was a Zionist collaborator for 30 years, it would even be better today if he was in power instead of this madman Sisi. So what people need to understand is that when you see protests, when you see demonstrations, when you hear about regime change, it is never something to back, no matter how much you oppose that individual or that ideology. You need to look for the hands behind it. There's only been a few times in the last several decades where there has been an organic coup, an organic revolution. You had it in Egypt with Nasser. You had it in Libya with Gaddafi. You had it with Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso. You had it with Chavez. And actually, this wasn't a coup. That was a true democratic election in 1999. You, of course, had it with Iran in 1979. And you've had it with Ansarullah in Yemen in 2014. But these are very, very rare occurrences. And you see, when these things come to pass, the monsters move in to crush them. So, gotta discern the truth.
Jonathan, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I hope to do another show with you. You're a very impressionable person, and you are a true friend.
Thank you, my dear brother. It was my pleasure and my honor to be on, and all my salams and love and blessings to you.
Good night, everybody. I hope you enjoyed this show, and please download this and pass it on.
This is a public service announcement.
There is a serious problem facing our world today. People are actually believing what they see on TV and read in mainstream news. This has got to stop now. Jews own our media, and they are lying to us in order to achieve their objectives. The Holocaust, 9/11, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, the Charleston church shooting, and many more events were either Jewish false flags or hoaxes. Don't be a good goy. Get wise to the Jewish lies. Thank you.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who send the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom. And we